Welcome back, everyone. This is Austin Roberts. Here on the Ecosiv podcast, we engage leading thinkers in conversations about the kinds of transformations required to create a more sustainable, peaceful, and just world.
In this episode, Andrew Schwartz talks with Indra Adnan. For over two decades, Indra has been writing, consulting, network building, and event organizing on themes like the future of politics, conflict transformation, the role of the arts, and integral thinking. Her recent book is called The Politics of Waking Up: Power and Possibility in the Fractal Age, which includes many of the themes discussed in this episode. And now, here's Andrew and Indra.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ecosiv podcast. I am your host, Andrew Schwartz, co-founder and vice president of Ecosiv. Today, we have a wonderful special guest with us, Indra Adnan. And Indra has spent a couple decades, right, over the last 20 years or so, pretty much blowing people's minds, writing, consulting, network building, event organizing, and covering themes like the future of politics, conflict transformation, the role of the arts, and integral thinking. So there's plenty for us to possibly cover. She is founder and co-initiator of The Alternative UK, which is a political platform that answers the question, if politics is broken, what's the alternative? Something definitely worth exploring today. While doing that, asking that question, right, if politics is broken, what's the alternative? The Alternative UK also works to build citizen action networks, which is reconnecting people to cosmo-local ecosystems of available solutions. So it's not just abstract, but she's working on actual solutions to some of our complex social and environmental challenges, political challenges. Indra has also been writing. She's been consistently writing about things like soft power, public democracy, the power of attraction and relationship and international relations, and has been doing that for over a decade. So a busy career. But if that wasn't enough, she's also a psychosocial therapist, a founder of the Soft Power Network. She does writing and events as a producer, has consulted with some of the most influential bodies of people in the world, the World Economic Forum, multiple governments, including the Indian government, Finnish government, Danish governments. She's consulted for NATO, Scottish Executive, and the Institute for Contemporary Arts. The list goes on. So I'm a little intimidated to be talking with somebody of such a caliber, but here I am. Indra is also currently co-lead in a group called Beyond Bounce, which is a social enterprise network that's doing transformative work to cohere and connect the next global economies. So like I said, a large range of topics for us that we could be covering today. We'll see where the conversation goes, but I definitely encourage anybody who wants to know a little bit more about Indra's thoughts and about most of what we'll be talking about today to check out her book, fairly new book, The Politics of Waking Up, Power and Possibility in the Fractal Age. So Indra, thank you for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here, Andrew, and I'm looking forward to our conversation, because I've read all about the work of Ecosiv. I'm a little bit involved with it now, and I think it's going to be a fun conversation.
Yes, as is appropriate, you think the World Economic Forum, you know, major, you know, governments, NATO, and Ecosiv, all sort of in the same level of conversation, I think.
Yeah.
That's as appropriate, yeah. Maybe someday, I don't know. Well, let's get started. Let's dive in. I think I mentioned your recent book, The Politics of Waking Up. And in that book, you talk a little bit about, among other things, your own experience of waking up, you know, which is sort of tied to being woke and all these sorts of things. And there's all sorts of things you could say about that. But I wonder if you can sort of describe your own experience that sort of is drawing you into these topics of interest and conversation. What are you waking up from? What are you waking up toward? What was this transition like? You know, all those sorts of things.
Good. Because, you know, if I look back to my childhood, as many people do these days, right? And I wonder, how did I end up doing this? You know, why am I doing this? And I would say there's two formative experiences in my childhood that led to this directly. And both of them are not the waking up part, if you like. They're more like the shadow. You know, what was the shadow I was operating in? And the first one was that I was born in Holland and then moved to the UK. Now, my father was Indonesian, my mother was Dutch. In Holland, that's a very familiar combination of colonial and colonized, right? So the Dutch powers and the Indonesian subjects, if you like, these were my parents. And so from my father's side, a Muslim background, my mother, a Roman Catholic, two very different ways of being in the world, actually, which they managed to bring into a happy family, who then moved to the UK. And although we had a good set of circumstances, we had, you know, my father had a good job and so on, that wasn't the problem. It's just that when we moved to the UK, we were definitely now the other, right? We were something that was not easy to fathom, and we were not British. And so early on, my experience of living as an outsider, but feeling like a global citizen, was very formative for me. Even learning the English language was a task that my family took on quite piecemeal, actually. And, you know, observing how my father was in the space, you know, how we were as children. Anyway, a lot of learning experience. We left in Holland. We left behind my brother in Holland when we moved because he was young enough, or old enough, I should say, to continue his education there. He didn't come with us to the UK. And at the age of... although we've visited every holidays and so on, he was just at the point where completing his education. He stayed in Holland. When I was 11, he died in a car crash while we were separated in that way. And it was, well, you can imagine, it was my, in fact, what occurred for me was it was my grappling with destiny or fate or whatever. I remember spending the whole night thinking that my brother's life was on the line and arguing with God, you know, to save his life. And, you know, it was obviously, I was a child, you know, and I had no idea what it was that I was trying to do. But the fact that I failed to do that became very, it shaped me a lot. And, you know, as I was growing up to be a teenager, my mom had seven brothers and sisters, all of whom died of cancer while I was in my teens. So all of this early part of my life was me grappling with death and my lack of power and agency in determining outcomes of this kind. And so, you know, as a child, I was doing the very deep, deep work of like how to make sense of your life. I was making my own religion up in my mind, if you like. But I had to be very, I was very distanced from reality when I was, in that time I was growing up. My mom became very depressed, as you can imagine. My father almost became absentee because it was too hard to be in the space with us all. It was quite a dark period, even though we had a lot of privilege. So we had enough privilege, but we had this really deep shadow in our life. And that was, I would say, set me on the path, a lifelong path of trying to understand what is agency, what is a human being, what kind of control can we ever have over the way that we live our lives and what the outcomes might be. And so it was with this mindset that I went into my early 20s and I went to Indonesia for the first time just to visit, you know, go back to my roots, actually, and trying to find out more about myself as a Indonesian. And it was there that I met Buddhism for the first time, which is unusual because it's a 93% Muslim country. But as it happened, a friend of our family, my uncle, so-called, was running this Buddhist movement. And I would go out with his movement into the different parts of Java and, you know, to villages, very small villages where people would have nothing. And I guess this was my early awakening to see how, when we went to visit a typical village, how when if we spent time with them and got them to pay more attention, if you like, to each other and to their own way of talking and being, that change would happen. So there was a word that my uncle used repeatedly. And at the time, you can try and imagine that I was this visiting English student age girl, and my uncle was talking in giving short lectures to people in a village in a remote areas in Indonesian. I didn't understand a word, but all the time he had this refrain going on. We used this word ada, right? And I thought I could hear him speaking and speaking. And go ada, ada, and I thought, what does that mean, right? And when he translated it for me later, he said to me, "It means it's there," right? So a typical, you know, sentence might be, you think you have no power, you do. You think there are no resources, there are. You think change is not possible, it is. So Ada always brought this sense of the thing you're looking for is already there. So how do you allow it to come into being? How do you change your awareness of it so that you can be part of this revelation of you have it already? And that was my early awakening, if you like, to shift myself into that mentality of we're not really wanting to change the world. We want to wake up to the world that is possible because it's already possible. And that very much has formed my way of acting and behaving. So whether it's through these many things that you said, you know, the conflict transformation work. So conflict transformation is not conflict resolution. The transformation comes from your imagination and your willingness to shift from a problem to a whole new world of possibility, conflict transformation. Or, you know, the willingness to, you know, see possibility in a single human being. Whereas before you might think, I need to do this for this poor person. I need to give them food. I need to give them a home. I need to give, you know, to move on from that to within this person is all the intelligence for them to be able to create, design their own system of change, their own structure for progress and so on and so on. So that's the underlying nature of it for me.
That's an amazing deeply personal story, and I love it, and I appreciate you sharing it. I think when I'm hearing you describe your own journey, it sounds like a big part of waking up to what's possible involves a transformation of the way we see the world, the way we think, and the way we understand sort of ourselves and our place in the world and the world around us and our relations to things. And I understand that integral philosophy and integral thinking is a big part of sort of the way that you have woken up and think about the world, perhaps differently than maybe you used to growing up. I'm curious because you mentioned, you know, your uncle being, you know, sort of, you know, learning some Buddhist insights, perhaps. How much does Buddhist philosophy, integral thinking, how much has that shaped their sort of shift in awareness, shift in consciousness, shift in, you know, sort of your worldview as a sort of process of waking up to what's possible for you?
Yeah, I think pretty formative. I should say, first of all, this kind of Buddhism, some people may not recognize some of the things I'm going to describe as the Buddhism that they know, because there's more than one school of Buddhism. I'm sure people are, you know, aware of that. This my form was very active, you know, I was part of a movement for culture and education and peace. And the philosophy is called the philosophy of the creation of value. So we as individuals are the creators of value, which is a very different way of looking at how communities come together or how change happens, because we hear a lot of talk about people finding those with who already share values, you know, whereas my approach is very much to really welcome diversity, disagreement, all of these things, but with a group that is highly diverse, you know, to create value of a new kind, new kinds of value that we haven't thought of before that will help us move into the future better. But specifically, just to try to tie your question into the bigger picture of waking up, really, because the way that I see it, that we've been in a revolution for about 30 years, all right? So ever since the birth of the internet, maybe more than 30 years, you know, there's been the opportunity for millions, billions of people to have a relative waking up. Anyone with access to a phone or any kind of broadband, internet at all, will be able to learn things they never could before that period, or to become aware. So become aware of history, to become aware of new tools and practices, to find their tribe, you know, and to share thoughts and feelings about things. You know, a simple hashtag, you know, can put you into a global connectivity with people who share, you know, your interest in, I don't know, harpsichords or whatever. You know, it's, you know, or in my case, soft power, you know, because I didn't realize how many people were interested in that as a method. And the final thing about that, which again often gets overlooked, is that the internet has given everyone the opportunity to put themselves in the public space, right? So whereas, you know, for the whole of history, the public space has been occupied by, depending on which part of the world you're in, but certainly in the Western world, by, you know, by white men, you know, commanding and designing that space, you know, the internet allowed everyone to put themselves into the public space, meaning I can see myself in this place. And that is a huge shift for consciousness and for people to feel their own beginnings of agency. And what we've seen, of course, is, you know, this movements of people finding each other, waking up to why their lives are the way they are, and deciding that they're going to try to leverage that information, grab the media headlines at any cost. So it's quite a chaotic space now of people competing for attention, and, you know, anything from, you know, in the early days we were talking Arab Spring or Occupy or, you know, various different political movements in different parts of the world. But now we're talking identity politics mostly, you know, women or trans or, you know, color. You know, it's like these are all movements of people who are trying to leverage their waking up and the energy of that, and realizing what is why they're in the position they're in, and trying to make change around that. You know, just make a lot of noise. So the question is, if everybody's trying to do that, where does that lead us? And how do you even explain that, the chaos of that? And integral thinking was important for me, specifically because it really explained why, even in a small room of people, you know, who haven't met before or who don't know each other well anyway, when they start up a conversation, or especially if they start up a debate or a discussion about something difficult, how it is that they can't even hear each other. You know, I'm sure you've been in that room, right, where people are talking, but they're talking right across each other. Like, one will say, yes, but, and then they'll say something quite different than replying to the person who spoke. So this idea of these multiple kinds of conversation happening at the same time can be very confusing and frustrating and make it impossible for people to progress. But where I found that integral thinking really helped me to understand was this theory of multiple forms of agency. So at different stages of your life, for example, you develop your agency. Typically, your child will go from being completely dependent on you as a parent to then noticing there's more people in the picture and start to leverage that, you know, and then you know, really wanting to see somebody take control of the space and make it a safe space, you know, who, like the teacher, you know, or the police, or, you know, looking for those signs that we can be safe. And then moving beyond that to strategizing, how do I use these different tribes that I can now perceive to the best, in the best formation? And then at some point, moving into what Tegra's called green, which is like more like a radical realization of the essential humanness of everyone, and that therefore they're, you know, their equal rights to power, which can be an incredibly human and enriching experience, but also you lose control of the situation at that point, because with every idea being coming relative, it becomes very difficult to make a progress. And then you go beyond that again to being able to see all of that, you know, and still find a way forward, because now you're designing for that diversity, you're designing for these multiple forms of agency. And that's where I find myself now with the community agency networks, is that the goal really is to design the right kind of containers for multiple different forms of agency to be able to nevertheless work coherently towards the kind of solutions our planet needs today.
That's fantastic. So you've said a whole lot packed up into that, which I want to sort of unpack a little bit. One of the themes that keeps coming up is power. And I think that's it's directly connected to a question you asked earlier, what is agency?
Yeah.
And, you know, to what extent can we have control over our lives? Which yeah. I think is a very fundamental human sort of question. As you describe the sort of development of, you know, a small child sort of growing up and discovering that. But power always happens in relation, which we might say everything happens in relation. So I know a lot of your work involves reimagining power. You talked about soft power. Could you say a little bit more about this? Why reimagine power, and how do you do it?
So I think it's just as important to think about what we used to think of as power, or what is the dominant narrative around power at the moment. And mostly when people think of power, they're thinking of power over, you know, how do I take control of something? And they're also mostly thinking hard power. In other words, this is, you know, how do I make something happen? So that's a kind of coercion, really. And that's what Joseph Nye, who was Bill Clinton's advisor, actually, and head of the Kennedy School of Government for a long while, that's what he made a distinction about. He said, so hard power is power over, and it's, you know, guns and money, you know, the tools of coercion, right? He said that is one kind of power, and it's the one that most people are trying to trade in, right? So mostly governments want to accumulate this power. They want to be they want to have monopoly over this kind of power. And, you know, at the time, which was in the 80s, 90s, you know, it was the era after America lost to Vietnam that some, you know, you had to ask big questions about where does our power lie? So, you know, the states, the only superpower really at that time, losing a hard power battle against a tiny nation, which succeeded with guerrilla tactics, you know, where actually is our power? And is it really valid to talk about power in that way? And what Joseph Nye uniquely said was, no, that's not the real source of America's power. The real source of America's power is its ability to attract. So the attraction is to the story of America, the American dream, if you like. So that is the big attractor. And what is the American dream? If nothing more than, you know, anyone can come here and become president. You know, everyone is welcome. Anybody born in whatever part of American society has a right, has a set of rights, can make a future for themselves, and they could become president. It's a dream of possibility. And it gave rise, obviously, to massive economy. And, you know, it released a lot of power in individuals. There's no question about it. But more than that, it designed its own system of amplification. So Hollywood, you know, or the American press, you know, these are the methods, the soft power tools that America's always had, now Netflix, if you like, to tell the story of the American dream. And because it was so pervasive and so convincing, because it was backed by hard power, people were always attracted to it. Everybody wanted to come to America. Everybody wanted a piece of America. Everybody wanted to be seen by the Americans. And when you have such a strong attractor, people move into relationship with you. As you say, you said, that's where the power lies, is that people are eager to form relationship with you, and then you have influence over them. So that is soft power. And, you know, sometimes when I talk about soft, because it's soft and not hard, people imagine that it's a kinder thing or it's a better thing. It's not. It's just another thing. It's a different form of power, and you can use it for good or bad. So, you know, one soft power triumph you might think about is Greta Thunberg, you know, sitting in front of the Swedish, you know, government building. The story of her life was incredible and had real effect on policy, ultimately, right? People changed the way they saw things, and new policy was formed. It isn't just a story. It's a story with an outcome. On the other hand, you know, somewhere else in our system, we had, you know, ISIS, who through the power of, you know, just producing a few brutal videos, you know, could do the same, you know, could tell a story of possible horror, if you like, that caused, you know, defense departments across the world to change their thinking. So soft power is very, effective, and it reaches right into your system to change where you are. And that happens on an individual level too. Anybody who has the capability of entrancing you or me can reach right down into my system and change the way I think about myself and the way I think about life and the way I think about my power.
There's so much overlap between your sort of presentation of soft power in contrast to hard power, and something I've studied, which is process theology, right. Sort of influenced by Alfred North Whitehead and Charles Hartshorne, John Cobb, and this idea that in societies that have been dominated by a Christian narrative and a view of God as all powerful, insofar as that view of divinity is described basically through the lens of hard power, you have a coercive God that sort of unilaterally determines all things in the world. It has power over everything, but is sort of affected by nothing. And process theology shifts that narrative around and says, maybe we need to think of God, if God is love, God is relational in terms of, well, like what you said, attraction. You know, process people describe sort of the lure of God, that God's power is not coercive and hard, but it's persuasive, that God's power is not unilateral power over, but sort of cooperative power with. And there's something that, you know, if you say, okay, well, the most powerful entity that can be imagined in this sort of cultural narrative is re-described in terms of relational power and cooperative power. What would that mean for changing the way that we imagine power in society and politics in our day-to-day lives? And it's so I resonate a lot with what you're saying.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. And the fact that both can coexist, I think that's an important thing to remember, because sometimes we think only if we convert everyone to this way of thinking will anything change. But it's not that. It's that we should have these both available and remember that they are two parts of the same system, and that we have to actively be investing in something over something else. But we won't obliterate the other. And sometimes we might even reach for it, right? If you want, you know, after all, we all know that you need money to achieve certain things, to create resources for things. But if you lose sight of the soft power aspect of it, you lose sight of everything, actually.
And actually, I think what you were describing too is this sort of interplay between soft and hard power, right? So that like sort of attraction and of persuasive power can actually enhance one sort of capacity for hard power through military force or something. I mean, I think that phrase you use, the tools of coercion, I think is a would be a great title for an article. go thou and create. There's so much we could explore in this. I think if I understand correctly, though, one of the projects that you've been working on that's near and dear to your heart is this, the Alternative UK. And that part of what that work involves is changing the sort of story, empowering people through describing the alternative, right? And getting people to imagine alternatives, which involves sort of rethinking power, rethinking relations, you know, rethinking agency, which is in a nutshell, rethinking politics. And you have that core question, if politics is broken, what's the alternative? Could you say a little bit more about how you believe politics is broken and what the alternative might look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, after this period of working with conflict transformations, spending some time working with the arts, exploring soft power, I did eventually get to the point where, you know, people had been saying to me for years, you know, if you don't tackle politics, you don't have any power. You know, you've got to be in politics. And I was thinking at the time, is that really true? But I was prepared to go and spend time finding out. And so I did my master's degree quite late in life, you know, politics administration, joined a political think tank, and even stood to be an MP in the UK, just to really immerse myself in the whole thing. But I found myself very quickly writing papers that were critical of the system, you know, and it's not difficult to do, to be honest. I mean, first of all, you know, it's designed to implode, right? This is to do with the UK specifically, but also relevant to the States. You know, you have two sides that are polarizing, but also they're competing on, you know, on principle, right? So 50% of the nation at any one time is invested in the failure of the other 50%, you know, and this is how it's designed. So is it surprising that we can't come to, you know, the kind of resolutions and solutions that we need in this time of crisis? We're not designed to do that within this political system. And if you look at what I call this the party political system, so only 2% of people across Europe and in the States are only ever members of political parties. So it's not that they don't have an allegiance. You know, people do have an allegiance, but the way that politics is designed, people don't get involved. They don't see it as relevant directly to them. They think it's somebody else's work. They're not even that interested in supporting very actively. So 2% of the people are signing up to political parties. What are the other 98% doing with their time? And that began to be the sort of you know, focus for us. Is what if this is the dominant narrative? Because of course, also the media is feeding off this 2% all the time. So everything that we think about where power lies, who we are as citizens, what is possible, is coming out of that 2%. And yet I knew that there was a lot more to tackling the future than that. And so we started to look in this arena, what is the 98% doing at this time? And we started to build a media around that. So we wrote a daily blog we've been doing it for 5.5 years now. And every single day we're writing about another approach to transformation in time for the crisis that we are perceiving. That's really the basis of, that's the first step. So let's say the building the new media system, telling a new story about human possibility. And what are the stories that we're covering? We started out with this question of what is the human being at the heart of that system? And a little bit like you've already mentioned, the shift from the idea that we're just homo economicus, you know, just needing a roof over our heads and food in our stomach. No, we are much more than that. We're biopsychosocial, spiritual entities that have infinite resources and needs to get met. So that's one of the basis of the blocks. The second is, what kind of power do we have as people coming together? At the moment, none. So therefore, what is the new infrastructure that we need to build power? I'll come back to that in a minute. And then the third thing is, you know, what is the impact on the planet? What kind of impact can I have on the planet? And, you know, in the old narrative, the old 2% system, none, actually. I just have to hope that my leaders will negotiate with those leaders and somehow they'll come to agreements, and I just have to hope and pray it works out well. Whereas in this new system that we see arising, it becomes really clear through the infrastructure that is now appearing that you as a human individual can have an impact on the planet with everything that you're doing. So it's just trying to get that axis and reporting along that axis and building the structures of that axis that we are involved in. And we're now, since the fifth year, we're now at the alternative global, because what we've seen arising, first of all, in the UK and in the States, we also see arising everywhere. So these, what I call fractals, these new patterns of relationship around community action are happening everywhere. So we want to report on them with the knowledge that they're happening everywhere. And that's why we're now the alternative global.
To hear that, people, if you don't reside in the UK, you are still part of the alternative.
Yes.
Because it is now global. That's exciting news. Yeah. You know, I think what I want to do now is to dream together. And I want to hear your dream about these alternatives. So I think part of this involves, in my understanding of some of your work, is that it involves expanding the feminine. Maybe we could talk about what that entails. But what would the future look like, right? Let's imagine 30 years down the road. What would the world look like if these sort of alternative systems and paradigms sort of power, of politics, of community were actually sort of became, if the 98% sort of became the dominant narrative and the sort of main, I don't know, the primary power dynamic. I don't even know how to frame the question, but does that make sense? Like, I want you to tell me, okay, so all your dreams come true. The alternatives have you continued to emerge, and there's sort of a transition in society, a flip of a switch, so to speak. What's the world look like? How is it different?
So we could take it in those three sections, if you like, because I see them as three realms of the human being, right? So, you know, as myself, as a human, as an ordinary human being, first of all, I would expect that I've redesigned my daily life, right? In 30 years, my daily life will be very different from what it is today. And partly it'll be much more balanced between what we now call work and what we might maybe now call play. These two things elide, you know, because if we are going to be developing our creativity and developing our agency, then the whole shape of our lives will change. You know, I will expect to, you know, do the things that, you know, that I need to do to keep my house in order or to keep my family safe or whatever. But I'm also taking part in how a community is doing that together. So I will have a much more public life, which will probably be paid in quite new ways. You know, it's not the same money system that we would have today. We'd have different forms of value, different ways of receiving resources. And we would, if you know, 30 years is long enough, I think, to really shift from this, you know, this overemphasis on the grind of work, you know, automation, artificial intelligence, a lot of the grinding work will be done by machines, in my view, as we move into the future. But a new form of work that we love that still requires us to use, our energy and our commitment, maybe more than we ever have, whether we're talking about, growing food and making new landscapes, or whether it's the challenging work of managing, not managing is the right word, but bringing, integrating the creativity of others to build real solutions, maybe having a very international life, being able to see what you're doing as directly affecting the five different continents and being in constant conversation with them. So just the way of being on the planet, we call it being a planetarian. I will be a planetarian as opposed to somebody who just lives in this house on this street. My consciousness will have developed in that way, and I will interact with people in ways that I don't do now. That's my expectation. And Andrew, I already see it in my son, and he's only one generation below me. I already see him not making the same problems that I made. He moved quite effortlessly into being a vegan, young in life, well before me. And, his life with other sentient beings is already different from mine. His relationship to music and movement is already way different from mine. His way of being in community, which started off with Facebook, but now is like, as you know, multiple forms of communities that he's actively playing a role in. It's already so fluid compared to the way I can be. I'm always catching up, but he's always ahead with this because he doesn't have the baggage of trying to let old stuff go. He simply moved into it from birth. So that's how I see it. And the community life will be, I imagine community life will just be richer, to walk out of your house, to know and feel who you're living amongst, and to be able to have, sister and brother organizations all over the world that you're sharing methods with, and to have a media which recognizes what you're doing in relationship to what's happening at all these other levels means that you'll always feel like you have power. So, that's it in a nutshell. And I think that there's a core, it's a shift of belief. Whether you think it's a belief system or you call it a new belief or whatever, it doesn't really matter, because I think the experience for everyone is that their belief is expanded and relocated. They're not going to believe in government or the boss anymore. The belief lies in what you're capable of yourself and what your community is capable of, and being able to trust that there's other people around the world. I'm not sure it's going to be the 98%. I don't imagine it could be. More like the 30 or 40% who care about it, who are interested, active, invested. But we'll see that the benefits of that will spread beyond the people who are active in it. Well, that's the point, really.
I love it. That's a great dream. And I'm actually inspired by the fact that you mentioned, these younger generations are... don't have to shed as much baggage. They're sort of just moving right into this alternative because it's more intuitive to them. And there's new tools that are at their disposal and new ways of communicating and belonging. And okay, so maybe my next line of questioning doesn't even make sense then, because I was then going to say, okay, well, if this is the world we want, like, how do we get there? What's the major obstacle to realizing our future? You just described, what's the challenge to overcoming our challenges? But what I'm hearing is it's not something that is forced. It's something that emerges. And it's not something where you say, okay, well, here's our 5-point strategic plan for how we change the world. It's something that maybe it develops more subtly, but not without significant shifts. So actually, one of the things that I thought was interesting listening to you talk about the creation of value, thinking about power, thinking about politics, and tools of coercion. You named guns, maybe armies or something, but it's like, okay, what about money? Is money a tool of hard power, a tool of soft power, both, neither? But then that got me thinking, okay, so what's the role of reimagining economies in realizing this alternative future? You know, the creation of value beyond GDP. I mean, so I know that's one of the areas that you're interested in, is sort of imagining and moving toward transforming next to the next economy. What's the function of reimagining and restructuring economies in sort of realizing these alternatives that you were describing?
Well, it's core, actually, and that's the reason I joined Bounce Beyond, is because I really want to learn more and understand more. But the core aspect of it is that, you know, money itself is simply a currency, isn't it? It's a tool. It's a promise, right, that we exchange with each other. It's not the money itself which is the root of all evil. It's the way we behave with it, you know, or what we do with it. And something that I've learned to understand a bit more is that capitalizing, or capitalism, if you like, as an emotional, what is the emotional action, you know, of capitalism? And it is to take money out of the system and bank it, you know, to capitalize, you know. So something has growth, you create profit, you kind of take it out of the system and bank it, and then, you know, grow through interest or through whatever, you grow it on its own terms. And that extraction, that form of extraction, is the same as the way we've treated nature. You know, we've taken the value out of it for ourselves and tried to create abstract forms of value from it, rather than investing in the thing, the original, you know, thing that you're extracting from, which on the one hand is the labor of human beings, or, you know, nature itself, right? So in the end, we have human beings and we have nature. And I'm going to go back to something that you asked before, you sort of threw in, but then actually took out again, which is, what is the role of the feminine in this, right? You know, and the role of the feminine, as I see it, is that because historically, you know, and I'm not going to go into the nature versus nurture, you know, but historically, women have not had power in the public space, right? They have had power in the private space, right? So that's two things, meaning one is that there's a lot of literacy on the inside, you know, feelings, emotions, privacy. In the privacy of a woman's life, there's been a lot more attention paid to how do I feel, or what is my child feeling, or what is, you know, what is that person feeling that I can connect to them on this internal level, if you like. So there's emotional literacy that women have, and then building structures to hold those emotional resources, which become constituent of a human being's agency, but also their happiness, right? What are those structures? The families, communities, you know, they're circular, they're relational, they're, you know, this is the natural way of women, actually, but it's always been in the yin space, right? Not in the light, always in the quiet private spaces, the domestic space. And so there's a very strong capacity amongst women for building relational architecture. And I feel that that's what we're talking about now as we move into the future, is that that capacity has to move more into the public space to help us design more spaces in this time of crisis where people can feel emotionally secure, but also empowered, you know. So I don't think this is the alternative, doing this to communities, not at all. What we're doing is acknowledging this already is there, ada, right? It was always there, it's there now, it's, you know, and then, you know, I have a habit of saying to men who are trying to build artificial intelligence or, you know, the new technology that will cause all this relationship to happen. And I say, you know, guys, the technology you're looking for is a woman.
Right.
And it's so often the case, right?
Fabulous.
That in, you know, that in places where communication can't happen, women are able to create, you know, the space in which communication can happen, or they can bring, you know, complex conversations to some sort of conclusion because simply by holding the space, not by making things happen, but by allowing things to move into relationship. So because historically that's been our, you know, our skill. So, you know, that's a big part of the evolution, as you rightly say. What I'm resisting, which always comes back to me, is that, oh, right, so you've got a gradual approach, you know, which is sometimes people feel that that's not enough, right? But actually, in this age of the internet, that is not gradual. That is the very thing you need to be skilled in, because that's happening faster than anything. So whether you're talking TikTok or you're talking, you know, conspiracy theories abounding, you know, or it's all about relationship, storytelling. You know, you need the skills of bringing people, you know, who are really different into a conversation with each other. And those are not easy skills to develop. And it's not simply the technology of connection. It's the technology of relationship, which is more than simply connection.
So much good stuff there. I definitely want to pull out the fact that I think, and I think I probably, I may have misspoken here too, is that the sort of a soft power transformation, an emergent alternative is not a slow transformation. It doesn't have to be gradual in that sense. It means that it's not being forced. It's not sort of a coerced, colonizing kind of, you know, imposing transformation, but one that sort of comes from within. But as you said, our world is changed. So, I mean, things are moved so fast. Transformation happens so quickly. Connections and narratives. I mean, all of this stuff, communities are really growing at a rapid pace. But I also love how you circuit it all back around and said, "Ada," right? It's where it's not about trying to sort of build something that doesn't exist. It's not trying to create something out of nothing. It's sort of, and I guess that is almost like a shift for myself thinking about this is, if you have sort of a hard power paradigm that you're sort of applying to the problem, okay, how are we going to make change happen? How are we going to build an ecological civilization through sort of force and, you know, sort of hard power means? But if you recognize that actually it's something that's already emerging, it's already there, and that it's there globally, as you said, not just in the UK, and that it's about sort of, I don't know, capturing, recognizing, harnessing, appreciating, cultivating, nurturing, whatever word we want to come up with that is appropriate for how we can sort of, I don't know, support the emergence of that sort of alternative as becoming more and more sort of visible, influential.
I mean, it's what you're doing. I see what Ecosiv is doing, and sometimes in ways that others aren't yet doing, right? So to draw attention to something, to give something attention, right, is to grow it, actually. It's not a, you're not making it happen. You're just giving it your attention. And, you know, you've got a child, I know. You know that when you gaze at your child, you give the child enough attention that they grow through that, right? They're downloading your system onto their system, right? They are growing in the light of your attention. And you grow from it. So, and that is one of our basic emotional needs. It's one of the things we need to be human, is to give and receive attention. So it's quite simple, really. And when you think of that as a media system or a comm system related to a media system, wow, it's just planetary attention giving to the thing that we're trying to grow, right? Or that we want to grow by giving it. It's more like the way light develops a plant, for example, than, you know, the plant already is designed to be a certain plant. It's already, you know, it's in its genetic formula. It's going to be something, right? But it can't grow without
light. Social photosynthesis. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. That's it. That's it. Exactly. That, you know, and yeah. I was going to say something else.
You were going to say something smart, and I interrupted with a dumb joke.
No. It's because I love that, and I like to be arrested by that thing because I'm going to remember it now. But I know what it was: attention, and the other one is investment. Right. So if you see something that is good, and you just think that's a great thing, invest yourself in it. So invest yourself, meaning give it time and energy, you know, pay it its due, but also, yeah, bring investment to it, you know, not by telling it what it has to do with this money, but by allowing it to use your money to do things, right? So another great example of that, how it can go wrong. In the UK, David Cameron, you may remember, one prime minister back, about to be two, who invented something as one of his major policy offers, you know, the big society, he called it. And this was this big, great plank of his manifesto. But when it actually came into being, his idea was ADA, right? His idea was, it's already there. The wonderful men and women and the wonderful people of our community, they already know, they already are able to like get the whole system changing, and we're going to trust them to do that. And we're setting up this massive fund, right, to help them do the work they do. But in reality, what he did was he did set up a massive fund, and then he appointed all sorts of new agencies with young guys in charge to tell the communities how to you know, make their communities better. And they actually took funding away from the women who were already doing the important work. And they set up this whole new expensively run, you know, big salaried initiatives in local communities to prove their trust in the local community. Well, it was the opposite. You know, they just began to run the community from these new agencies. And the women actually lost their funding, and their relationships were broken up in the process. And they actually lost a lot of their influence. They had to really double their efforts as volunteers to keep the thing going. And that's the opposite of what we need. Yeah. You know, we're not here to tell people who they should be. We're here to show people that we see them now. I see you. I'm bringing you into my picture now. Now that I see you, I want to help you do what you do. That's the thing.
So, what I think the story you just told highlights for me, I guess just a realization that ADA, not just the alternatives that we're wanting, but also the sort of the current dominant system of domination, hard power, coercion, that and violence that has been sort of the narrative of modern industrial civilization. That too is a DAW. And so, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I find that sometimes a little bit, depressive. Like we're talking about, you know, money and politics and capitalism and unlimited growth on a finite planet. And we're talking about, 2% sort of dominating economies and cultures and media and politics and policies, and that the agency for everybody else is sort of being eroded through a paradigm that has been the sort of primary, you know, central piece of our of our story. And I think, I don't know, in the midst of that sort of recognition, right, when you talk about alternatives, it's because there's something existing that you want an alternative to. So what, I don't know, I mean, that's sometimes I feel a little overwhelmed, like, okay, so things aren't as rosy as I hoped. There's a lot of work to be done. But in the face of all that, I mean, is there anything that gives you hope that, like, something like what I would call an ecological civilization, a more sustainable, yeah, equitable, and peaceful world is actually possible?
Yeah. Oh, it's possible, right? And, you know, if you commit to it, then you'll experience that more and more. So probably you've had that experience in your own life more than once, you know, where somebody says to you, that's not a thing, and you know it is. For example, something that you like doing, or a person that you like that other people don't like, or, you know, a way to get from A to B. I mean, we've all had experiences where people, in a very small way, people don't believe it until you show them. But when you show them, then they believe it, right? And there always comes a moment where you have to either believe it's not worth it to show them, or you find it in yourself to say, no, I'm going to show you, right? And that's the energy we have right now. And what happened to me is that it was on the day that Jo Cox was murdered. I don't know if you know who Jo Cox was, but she was an MP who was murdered 5 days before Brexit by one of her own constituents who just disagreed with her choice. So she was going to be a Remainer. He thought we should vote Leave. And somehow the crazy media sphere that we all live in, you know, got to him, who was obviously mentally unstable, to think that somehow he was justified. He thought she was an anti-British person. He thought she was the enemy. That's what he'd been led to believe. And he murdered her. And on that day, I just jumped the system and said, that's it. That's enough of this media, you know, party political coercive, mistaken, you know, system. I'm jumping ship. And what's more, I'm going to cut it out of my life for the time being. I stopped reading the newspapers and I started to actively curate the space with my partner, Pat Kane, who is an editor and who had already a lot of experience in that field of building a new media. And he's a singer as well. So he has a different idea of what has influence, right? And we started to live in this world for a while. And the longer we live in this world, the more we know that this is the future, right? This is what's possible. And then when you start to look and you see all the architecture for meeting our targets by 2030 are coming into being now, but the solutions already exist. You know, you've seen what, you know, Hawken and others from the
Project
Drawdown have managed to, at this point, suddenly they've managed to play a major role in getting this budget turned around in the States. And we've got a moment, there's a moment of, oh, okay, we might be going in that direction now. But that's after decades of doing all the homework and finding, you know, and I think we're at that point now where a lot of the work that's been done over decades can move quite easily into people's imaginations, whereas before there was nothing to show them, right? So when Occupy rose up, for example, or the Arab Spring, when they rose up and they were reaching out for the tools to make it true what they were dreaming of, there was nothing there, right? You know, it's like Occupy might think about the 99%, but ultimately they just wanted to start from scratch because there's nothing they could draw on. And what we're trying to, you know, be part of growing is the idea that anybody can walk into a CAN, community agency network, wherever they live, and suddenly have direct, you know, contact and move into relationship with this global understanding of what is possible and is already coming into being. But their ability to connect to it is very important. So it has to be built, right? And the building of connecting the growing the cans, recognizing the many that are already there, all the ones that you described, and fitting them within a bigger system of change, all of this has to happen so that anyone anywhere can walk into it with their dream of a better future and suddenly find out that actually the infrastructure is available. I don't have to make it up. I don't have to start from scratch. It's just that I wasn't looking, and now I'm looking and I can find it. It has to be findable, but it has to come into being. And that's where we're at now. So what I love about ECOSIV and my exposure to the work you're doing is that you've gone even further than we were, much further than we were able to do in terms of reaching, for example, into China and to different parts of the world, having a really global perspective on this big picture of the eco-civilization, that somehow you've seen that other people are dreaming of it, you know, and you're bringing it to light. And what we're trying to do is to work with you and bring the architecture into which anyone can step into this space and then be connected to the whole system. And that there's a media around that which will make it so attractive that even people who don't give a damn about it will still move towards it because it's got the kind of energy that we all want to be part of.
I love it. Talking to you is so fun. You're inspiring. You're so eloquent and brilliant, and I learn a lot from you. So thank you for taking the time to have such a wonderful conversation. We covered a lot of ground.
We covered it up. You set it out and we covered the whole thing. So that's your very skilled way.
That was, yeah. Well, I mean, just you had so many good things to say. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share. I think if those of you who want to know more about Indra's work, be sure to check out The Alternative and her book as well. We'll put links to both in our description of this episode. So, Indra, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
For me too. Thanks so much.